Hello, thank you for joining me. This is Ernestine Lyons, host of Quick to Politic, the podcast, the social commentary show that explores topics ranging from social justice to history, economics, small business, and of course, local and national politics. Thank you for joining me. Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Quick to Politic podcast. I am your hostess with the mostest, Ernestine Lyons, and I am here with a very special guest. So Quick to Politic is a social commentary podcast that we focus on contemporary issues. And I have been exploring, as a part of a series, Black Voices in Tech. So we have Neil Jones here, everybody. Say hello, Neil.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. You're amazing. And I'm super excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So we're actually exploring something that started as kind of a research project for me, which is, you know, with the emergence of artificial intelligence, who are the Black voices in Detroit leading the conversation on new and disruptive technology? And, you know, when it comes to innovation and, you know, just emerging technologies, like how can we make sure that people are not left behind by the digital divide? And as a process, I have been meeting very interesting people, and I found Neil's backstory very fascinating. He's a Detroiter and a video game designer. And so he goes by the name Ariel Knight. And I'm going to turn it over to you in just a second, but I think it was really interesting. I actually saw a quote in the New York Times from you. There was an article talking about particularly Black voices in game design. And you said that the video game industry has a type and you didn't fit the mold of what they thought a game developer looked like. So you decided to create your own thing. So with that in mind, that's a little bit about Neil, but let's hear it from you. Like, tell us your story and tell us about, you know, just you and your company and all the things.
Oh, so all the things, just everything.
Yes.
Everything. Well, the year was 1980. I grew up in Detroit. I was raised by my grandmother. She ran businesses and all that stuff, and she gave it up to kind of just raise me and my brothers, and did it all herself, with an amazing, you know, community. You know, I remember the names of all my neighbors, and you know, we would play outside and they would all just, you know, teach us different things. So very much a background of growing up just in Detroit by Black people and just being surrounded by, you know, that culture my whole life. She ran a restaurant. She had, not a restaurant. She was in those little restaurants that's in bowling alleys. It had an arcade. I would sneak into her diner area and just take the quarters and go to the arcade and just spend the days in there playing video games. And that's kind of like where all the video game stuff came from. Mostly, it, you know, she was really, really good about it. She had her own Sega Genesis, which was weird.
Oh, the old school ones. See, those are the ones that I always watch people, like my siblings, play for hours. I wasn't much of a gamer, but I love watching people play games.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would sit there and watch her, actually, because it was hers. It wasn't ours. And she would just play Bejeweled, and then I would just play with her. And it was like my favorite thing to do. And it's like the only way, as a kid who'd been through a lot of stuff, I could communicate was like through playing video games and things like that. So anyway, that was just, you know, how I, you know, found myself into games and this kind of stuff in general. I went to high school at Mumford, did terrible, barely made it out of school. Then I went to college, a trade school for game design. I went from like a C student to D student to like, I got straight A's in college.
Oh, because wow. I was really interested. You found your thing.
Yeah. And it was like a different way of learning. It was like more, you learn what you want to learn. And then, you know, the classes and teachers and it's kind of worked out. I kind of realized that I wasn't dumb. It's just like, I just wasn't interested in anything. But the school, you know, it was terrible. So I just kind of made the best out of it.
I can relate. I can definitely, I hated high school, middle school, all the schools until
what high school did you go to?
I went to Harper Woods High School, here in Harper Woods. You know, I grew up in Detroit and went to Detroit Public Schools. I went to Hutchison Elementary School. Then my mom homeschooled us, and as a re it, like while we were being homeschooled, we moved to the suburbs. So, graduated from Harper Woods High. I absolutely like was such a nerd and a loner. I didn't really have that many friends, and so I
Yeah,
found
it's funny
my
how
fellow people when I got to college.
the loners turn into like the best people in college, you know?
Hey, all right. Shout out to our loners out there.
Right? Stay in your corners and don't talk to nobody. But I came out of school, just had day jobs, really couldn't find like a spot for myself. End up working at a couple of tech places, making apps and things like that in Detroit. Interned at Vectorform, blah blah blah, boring tech stuff. Moved to Texas for this program, and then I went to UT for a couple of years. Did some work with USC in LA,
Oh,
and then
nice.
came back to Detroit. Was just real frustrated with the game industry. Like you said, I couldn't find like a place. Like I would get these amazing comments on my like work, but when I went to apply for the job, they, you know, with a name like Neil Jones, they expect something else.
Expecting something else, right?
And then I hop on a call and they're like, "Oh, okay." Interviews are real quick after they see my face. And it was always weird comments like, "You know, you're not, you know, your stuff is great, but you're not fitting the culture that we're trying to build." And that's a big thing. The game industry is like, well, it used to be where they say that they're looking for a specific culture. But then all the teams would just end up being white. It happens less nowadays, but it's still, you know, the game industry is still like 3%, I think, now black. And that's compared to everybody else. I kind of just gave up for like a year on game stuff. And I was like, I'm going to my 30s. I need to kind of do something because this game stuff isn't working out. But I spent so much time, you know, learning all these different tools that was so specific to the game industry that I said that I was just working a day job with my friend Dan. He was like a janitor, and I was like at the front desk just checking people in at this tennis club. And we had a lot of downtime, so I said, you know what, I'm gonna give myself a year. I'm gonna take all these things that I know. I'm gonna make the coolest, you know, portfolio piece ever. It's gonna work. And you know, if I don't get a job off of this or people don't like it, then you know, I'll give up on it and just find some other career. But if it works, which I didn't think it was gonna work, nobody thought it was gonna work. But if it works, you know, this is my end. I can't nobody tell me nothing, you know. So I started making it. I paid Dan because Dan's an amazing musician. But he had a lot of the same struggles I had with trying to get into the game industry. And he did the music for the game. We kind of just made this like trailer-ish thing and just got started posting it on Twitter, got invited to a couple of showcases, and then Nintendo saw it, and you know, publisher saw it, and you know, everything kind of blew up from there. But now, you know, we're working on multiple other games. We're funded. Everything's going really well. So I travel around a lot and get to talk to parents and kids and just talk about game industry in general. And kind of use the story of how this game was created as an example of, you know, there's multiple different things and multiple different ways you can get into it.
All right, all right. And so the name of the game is Never Yield. And
Yeah, Aerial
so,
Knights Never Yield,
okay,
specifically.
Aerial Knights Never Yield. So that is the ultimate story of perseverance. And you know, you would think that you wouldn't still have to face these barriers, but I think that that's our lived reality. It's like, yes, there are so many things that, you know, people, especially having like, I don't know, names that kind of sound traditional. And then when you show up, it's just like, oh, well, yeah, that's definitely not what I was expecting. And so I think that's been my experience for a lot of different things. But I think in particular, like in tech, it is a lonely field. And I have some statistics here about like just the video game industry. I know I think maybe our parents' generation, they're just like of this mindset that says like, you know, oh, you're just playing video games and things. But no, it's this is actually a space where there can be a lucrative create career to be had. You know, the global video game industry is valued at about 159 billion, and in 2020, you know, it had this compounded annual growth rate of about 9.3%. And, you know, as of, you know, these are old statistics, but as of 2020, the video game industry contributed about 90 billion to the US economy. And so it's definitely something that, you know, everybody enjoys it to an extent. Nobody's just like, oh, I hate this, you know. So it's a place where I think a lot of creativity can be had. And I actually was watching, you know, I was just like kind of watching some of the scenes from Never Yield. And like there was a couple of, I was doing my research and there were a couple of video game clips of it. And it just looks so, the you are an artist. I see the design there. And it actually reminded me of the new Spider-Man movie where that design is, it's really breaking through and forcing us to be creative. We don't want to see the same styles of, you know, design over and over again, but it's just really creative. And so I really want to thank you for coming on my podcast. So we're gonna get right into some of the questions that I feel like I probably asked you this. We actually met at Black Tech Saturdays, so I may have asked you this question before.
Oh no, it's
So
fine. I get the same questions all the time.
Right. So, okay. You are a Black Tech founder. And so, what specific policies do you think could help foster a more inclusive environment for Black Tech entrepreneurs? And how can influential figures, you know, in the industry, such as yourself, advocate for these change? And then, how can folks like me, who, you know, former elected official, how can we contribute to that change? And you know what? Okay, and then I'll ask this other question after that one. So yes.
Do you mean like how can founders just like make sure that their space is inclusive and like welcoming and all that?
Yes. I mean, because your experience, you know, you said this was like, you know, you spent 10 years and so it's different now, but at the same time, you know, there could be a cognitive, like a bias or a, you know, just kind of cognitive dissonance where it's like game designer in Black, the one they don't fit and this is not. And so what can more folks in the industry do to just really be like, hey, I'm going to hold your feet to the fire. You say you want diversity, then let's start going to different places, different, you know, avenues to look for talent.
And like kind of just what you said. I think me specifically, I work with a lot of different people, a lot of different races. I have, you know, a studio in London, and I have like people in San Francisco and all over the world. And they're all different races, different backgrounds, and all these things. And it doesn't matter to me as long as they get the work done, you know. But I think in general, like when I first started, I just wanted to work with Black people. You know, I wanted to work with my friends, people I knew, people I trusted. And it just worked out for me. I think it comes down to a lot of people's experiences. So if you want a person to be more inclusive and open to anybody and everybody, then that person needs to be a person who's been around, you know, traveled a lot, met a lot of different people, been in a lot of different cultures, and know how to communicate with people without being offensive, you know. And sometimes, you know, they're offensive, but it's not, you know, intentional. You know, it's just like kind of where they come from. And I'm not giving them an out or anything like that. I'm just saying, you know, if you've been raised in Nebraska your whole life and you ain't never been nowhere else, as soon as you get that culture shock, you don't say the wrong thing every now and then. So I would say I don't think we can do anything about like people who want to start up a business and just say, like automatically tell them you have to be inclusive and diversity and all that stuff. I think we should support the people who have those like extensive backgrounds and who have shown that they're really inclusive and they know how to act. You know, let somebody, you know, show you that they know what they're doing and they know how to like treat people before you kind of just like automatically back them. So I think, you know, it's a little bit on us. You know, it's a two-way system. You know, you can't just automatically support somebody. You got to let them prove to you that they're worth, you know, you taking the time to look into them. Because, you know, we get disappointed in the Black community a lot. We're like, oh man, we were really rocking for that person and they turned out to be a terrible person, you know?
Right. And, you know, I think there was a quote. So last week's guest was actually Johnny Turnage, who started Black Tech Saturdays. And there's a gathering just for the audience out there. And so the last Black Tech Saturday meeting that I was at, there was actually there was a speaker who encouraged us all to be patient with, you know, this is a part of the growing process. And most startups, they do the beta testing. They have that first maybe 50 customers and, you know, they launch a product, they have an app, and then the users give feedback. And that's how the company, you know, grows. And that's how the company is able to make improvements, do updates. And the speaker at Black Tech Saturdays was saying that we're quick to give up. And it's like, oh, this is Black. So, oh, it didn't work right. So, you know, I'm gonna just go back to whatever it is I've been using. But it's like in tech spaces, that feedback is actually how you get through, you know, all of these rounds of testing, and you make upgrades and you make something better, you optimize it. And I think that kind of is important for us to stay, you know, just stay with a product, stay with an app or a company, and, you know, give them the feedback and say that I wish this was better. You know, we can do more of this or less of that.
I think it's a little bit also to go on what you just said. It's a harder for Black people because they only get one shot to mess up, you know. Mm-hmm. As soon as they mess up, then you're like, oh, I knew it.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So me, I'm just like extra careful. I'm not extra careful. I think part of the thing that like has people gravitate towards me and my story and the games and stuff like that is my genuineness. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like just put it all out there on the table because I wasn't expecting anything anyway. But for other people who are actually trying to like be here for a very long time, they have to just be so careful with everything that they say or post or, you know, the people that they hire, they have to just make sure they hire the right people all the time. So a lot of times there's like an overcorrection, but it's an understandable one, you know?
Right, right. And I think that kind of gets to that like old adage where it's just like you feel like in your head, at the back of your mind, it's like you have to work twice as hard and make sure that everything is just perfect.
You do though, because you're talking to me and like you've looked stuff up about me, but a lot of people don't know me. And that's cool. But just to get into the game industry, I had to not only make my whole, my own whole game, it had to launch on every platform. Mm-hmm. And it had to be successful. And I had to start my own company.
That couldn't have been easy.
Yeah, before I even got like a good job offer. So Black people still have to like do so much more.
Right, right. And I definitely, you know, think that, you know, hopefully we can work on policies and we can work on like sort of factors that lead to more people, you know, being recognized, more mentorship. And I think that mentorship and that, you know, just ability to, for someone to be given chances and, you know, then those chances open doors. And then, you know, that it just becomes the snowball effect where you're able to do more because somebody believes in you and because opportunities are opened. And so that's really important. So, you know, what role do you see for public-private partnerships in this process? And I kind of keep alluding to the creation of mentorship programs or, you know, programs for, you know, spaces for this collaboration to encourage that mentorship.
Mm-hmm. And sorry, I keep changing, like closing my blinds and opening them. Like the sun keeps coming in and out, and I'm like,
No, exactly. I mean, that's the thing about like, you know, this world of like, if your podcast audio was perfect, then it's like the audio visuals, and like, yeah, eventually this podcast is gonna be.
Hey, I'm trying to be like you. You got the perfect lighting. All that.
It's a ring.
I think in the gaming space, it's really rough doing mentor stuff because everyone has such different ways that they got into the game industry. You talk to 10 different people, they got 10 different stories of how they got into it. Some people come from movies, some people come from, you know, just animation or whatever, and they can, you know, kind of fall into gaming because it's another job, right? But for tech in general, I think, we have to have startups who know about events to go to, right? And then we have to have founders who's willing to give up their time to go to events and talk to people, because a lot of times it's really rough to say, let me give up my afternoon, which I'm incredibly busy. Let me give up my afternoon to go talk to people who need help, you know, or who are looking for advice, or let me just be around for somebody who might need advice, you know. So that's a lot of maybes for a lot of time to give up to kind of go looking for someone to help, which I don't really do. I let people reach out if they want help. And then, you know, I'll gladly offer it. But, you know, the time thing is this, it kills me sometimes.
Right. And you were talking about just like efficiency practices and things. I know last time at Black Tech Saturdays, but you know, just it really it gets back to just kind of really the need for all of us to even know about each other, you know, to know that, you know, there is a 2% person in the space and, you know, they're creating and, you know, this is their story. And that's really important. So I really think that, you know, it's important to share your story because it is inspiring. And so, what advice would you give folks who are hoping to go down your path, become a video game designer or developer, or, you know, you mentioned, you know, you use a lot of software that, you know, a lot of it is like animation, design. And so, like, if someone wants to be in the creative space, either as, you know, an illustrator or developer, what advice would you give them for navigating this industry?
So like people ask me that a lot, and I always tell them the same thing. I tell them don't take anybody's advice, because like I said, there's every single person in the game industry has a different story of how they got into the game industry. So to if they followed my path exactly, it probably wouldn't work out for them. In general, though, I tell people just learn stuff, figure out what you like. Like you could say that you want to code, but then you really fall into animation and you like that a lot. And you just stick with that and kind of like follow on Twitter, like the animation person who's in the game industry and whose stuff that you like, and look at the portfolio and just try to mimic them and make that kind of stuff. And if you really enjoy it, then, you know, apply to some jobs, just post stuff. A lot of times people just post stuff and then they get jobs. But you know, that's just getting a job. You got to do something you like. You got to figure out if you even want to be in this industry. It's a lot of different things to it. But like just blindly like taking someone who you don't know is advice, I think that's a terrible idea.
Okay, so as a millennial, I feel like I grew up in the generation of I need to ask mom more about this. I need to ask. And so I'm always like, oh, what does my sister think? Or let me ask her. Let me ask my sister's opinion. Let me ask my dad's opinion. Let me ask my, you know, what does my brother think? And so it's just I do think that it's really important to trust yourself, to trust your intuition, and to recognize that somebody may want you. And then that's the thing about it. We started this conversation talking about our parents' generation not recognizing that this billion-dollar industry is now a actual job, you know, just kind of it's a career. And this is something that wouldn't have existed. And so that's the thing, like, especially taking advice from parents, I think, you know, they have this concept of, you know, you want to work for this company for, you know, 15, 25 years, and that is not the
That
economy.
doesn't exist anymore.
No. And then the jobs that they would have relied on for that amount of time, you know, they don't exist anymore. And, you know, there are some statistics out there that say that, you know, high school age kids are even more confused now, and they don't know what they want to be because the industries that exist as their little kiddos right now, who knows what they'll be, especially with the emerging, you know, generative AI capabilities that can replace them. I was, you know, at a College for Creative Studies demo day where all of these illustrations were on display, and there's just so many brilliant designs. And, you know, as a comic book nerd, I'm just like, ooh, look at that. I love this. Oh, that's so beautiful. And I'm just like, I'm starry eyed. And then I kind of got a little sad because I get on Midjourney and I can create the same things with generative AI. And it's just like sort of sad that you've got this generative AI who can mimic something that they've seen on the internet, but they can't really creatively, you know, come up with it on its own, but it can mimic someone else's work. And so I think that's the thing about these industries. It's like, yeah, you can ask for advice, but, you know, who's to say that, you know, that career is going to exist? Do you really want to go after the thing you're passionate about? But it's really about a moratorium, I think. You know, you really have to explore. You really have to take some time. So I don't know. Like, I like your advice because I think that it's the youngest possible, start exploring things. Because as long as you're trying on, like, oh, I kind of like that. No, I didn't like that. If you find that out when you're like, you know, 20 or 18, it's better than like not trying anything until you're like 25. And then you're just like 28 and kind of like, oh man, I wasted time in that field and I hated it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard to tell what's gonna happen, you know. I don't even know if this is like the last generation of like physical art like that because of AI, you know. It really depends on how the laws and stuff go, but you know, this money and art never mix well in the first place, so
Right. And, you know, art is so subjective and it's really all about like who's interpreted and who adds value to it and why. And so it's definitely, you know, one of those things. So I think we kind of delved into one of the questions that I had on like, you know, just the industry. And but I'd kind of like to, you know, spin that question a little bit. We talked about the legislation in the industry for better support. What specific changes would you like to see in the next 5 to 10 years when it comes to supporting folks who want to go down this path? And then it gets back to the question that I remember you asked a question at one of the Black Tech Saturdays about, you know, how can politicians kind of like, you know, hey, we need more of this and that. And it's kind of hard for like me to find the job that is right for me. So how can you encourage that? And what's your hope for the next 5 to 10 years when it comes to like encouraging programmatic sort of focuses on encouraging more tech innovation?
Yeah. So things that I think can be done right now, and it's pretty much like climate change. Like, we got to do it now or it's too late, you know. We need to not give grants or tax cuts to any company using AI. You know, if they want to use AI to cut all their staff and save money that way, fine. But, you know, the taxpayers' money shouldn't be paying for funding their replacements, you know.
That's actually a good idea. I'm just like, yeah. Really would. And then, like, nope, you don't get this subsidy or that grant.
Right. And then beyond that, places like McDonald's and Myers with the self-checkouts and things like that. If you have that, then, you know, again, almost just like AI, if it's something that's replacing a human's job, then there needs to be a cost to that, you know. It got to be more than, you know, you're paying a lot of money for this expensive device that's going to just work 24 hours without any, you know, whatever. If you're going to put that in there, fine, go for it. But taxpayers shouldn't really be supporting you or giving you any tax benefits or breaks because of that. Because I went to McDonald's the other day and they had this little tiny, like, if you go to the Detroit airport, you'll see it. They have like all those the stands where you can like digitally order your stuff.
And one little the kiosk booth, kind of thing.
Yeah, the kiosk things, which is like kind of in between AI and just machines replacing people. But also, you know, that it's just weird, you know.
And that's the thing, like these are huge corporate, the huge corporations are always going to be the first to adopt some expensive technology that really replaces the person that you wouldn't, you don't even want to pay $15 an hour. You know, we had to fight for 15 and let in, you know, with a lot of, you know, legwork and in grassroots advocacy, and they didn't even really want to pay that. So it's just, yeah, but yet you easily are like, oh yeah, let's get these robots. Let's get this big giant
car
for all the
robots. And I'm not against robots and AI and stuff. I think there's places for that, like safety and like doing a lot of like double checking, safety checks, like for astronauts and like flights.
Imagine the
and
Challenger anything. Explosion. If, you know, exactly. if for example, like the Challenger exploded because of a problem with O-rings. And if there was a human who's supposed to check that and it was something that they missed. And so could you imagine if like you have like AI systems that can check this, but then a human would need to come in and double check, you know, because machines are fallible.
Yeah. But just things like that. Just like AI should be supporting the human task and not replacing it, you know. You know, I don't think anything's going to really happen. It's been real down here lately. For change, but hopefully our generation kind of notices it, because I'm just gonna say the last generation, they dropped the ball big time. Like, you know, they get on us for not knowing certain things. They get on us for like being lazy or whatever. Who raised us, you know? So it is what it is.
I mean, like,
we gotta fix stuff.
Most of us were raised, like if you're a millennial, you're probably raised by a boomer, and they just kind of like, it was a coddling kind of thing where it's just like, okay, well, I came apart because I was raised by somebody from the silent generation who taught me to be seen and not heard. So now I got all kinds of psychological issues. And so I want to make sure that my kid, you know, never has to do anything. And not to say that I think we are a very resilient generation, you know, millennials, and then going into Gen Z.
We were forced that way, you know. We started off 9/11 and wars nonstop, and then recessions. We came out of school with no jobs, you know. And then you think you have a summer job working at McDonald's, but no, our parents were working those jobs, so we didn't really have anything. We didn't even have summers really because it's too hot outside, or you know, couldn't breathe. Terrible things.
Pollution, and then of course there's global warming, and so I really think that it's a testament to how resilient folks are, because we don't get to have the same American dream, you know, when it comes to, I want to have a house, I want to raise a family. There are statistics that show that there are people who get married and there's like dual income, no kids, and that's kind of how they like it. Most folks are just like, I can't afford a kid, especially of a certain age, so therefore I just have pets. And so you see this steep rise in pet ownership. But that's because people want to have something that, you know, that little comfort person, you know, but you can't really afford it. So you get an animal. And so you're seeing more and more folks.
And on top of that, why would they want to have a kid if there's no jobs? What world are you bringing them into? Like, is it worth it? Right. And I think that's a good thing, because overpopulation is definitely a thing. You know, and you can say, oh, you know, you can, it's easy to say, but I don't have any kids. I don't plan on having any kids, just because it's just a lot, you know. And I'm really worried about the future, as far as like what would be left for them.
Right.
AI taking over everything, pollution, but having less kids kind of solves a lot of those issues. And if, you know, I think we as a generation are already going down that route of just like holding off on having kids or not having kids, you know, in general. I think like I said, our generation is going to have to fix and address a lot of these things.
Oh yeah.
For better or for worse.
For sure. For sure. Well, any other closing thoughts that you have on, you know, just systemic issues with, you know, the lack of diversity in tech overall, or, you know, any of the policy proposals that I'm pushing on you here, or just like things that, you know, have to do with, you know, just kind of our standards of living changing because of the way that, you know, the economy now functions, you know, and the economic impacts, like, you know, having less kids and having more pets, you know, what are some of your closing thoughts, and just views on some of those things as we close out.
Yeah. I think, you know, you make great points. I think we kind of just align on a lot of things. But I think more just listening to people, even the people that you don't agree with. I watch some terrible clips of like stuff on Fox News and stuff like that sometimes, just so I can hear like what their argument is and if they make any good points. And sometimes they make a good point. And I'm
right,
like,
the whole help me to understand, like, why do you believe this way? And then I will try not to jump down your throat and hear, like, let's share ideas in a, you know, logical way that's not, you know, heated and argumentative.
Yeah, because some people, I talked to, you know, when I worked, me and Dan was working at the tennis club. Lots of Republicans go to tennis clubs for some reason. You know, this is the time right before, you know, Trump got elected or whatever. So there was a lot of conversations about that happening. And then one of the dudes I was really cool with, he ended up being a Trump supporter. And I was like, man, what are you doing? You don't seem like the type. He was like, look, man, I'm just sick of these taxes. You know, like, I don't care about anything else. If the Democrats came out tomorrow and said, I will lower your taxes, I would vote for them. And I was like, all right. And then I became a founder and a business owner, 100% understand where
and
he's coming from
like,
now.
Oh, now I get, because that's the thing. Like when you are like a, you know, there's so many corporate tax breaks and things. And I think this is why, you know, fiscal conservatives tend to be more on that right wing kind of side of things, because it's just like, hey, my company's going to benefit when these folks are in power versus, you know, social programs that tend to proliferate when they're more left leaning folks in power. And so, you know, it's just like, huh, now I think I understand where this side is coming from, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, the money and politics and stuff like that, it's all really confusing. I think just people just like kind of looking into more of like the other arguments. And I can say I disagree with, you know, a lot of the right leaning side things because I understand them. It's very money driven, very big corporation driven. The oil companies run everything, you know, that type of stuff. But I think there is a lot of positives out there as well. You know, with the younger people finally getting into politics and trying to like yourself run, like getting places in office and like just having a voice. And I think more people like you coming forward, like as the years go on, would be just an amazing thing. Because like me, I just kind of vote, you know, the side I feel the most comfortable with. And like, I think we talked about, if I know your name, then we're in trouble. You know, I like to just kind of be at arm's length of politics. I like my peaceful life of just making video games and, you know, thinking happy thoughts. And then when it comes time to vote, I just do what I got to do and then come back to real life, you know?
Right. And that's the thing about it. I think there need to be more non-political, just voices in the mix so that there is this the stigma is taken away and more people feel like it's just like, oh, this affects me and this is how, you know. So when you break it down that way, I do think that this is why I do what I do with this podcast, because, you know, I stopped really leaning into interviewing politicians and I just wanted to talk to real people.
This sounds so fake, you know.
So wait, the politicians, they sound
The politicians sound fake even when they're being genuine.
It's sound bites. And I think that sometimes in politics, you really do have to, you know, be careful with your words, because people might capture a sound bite and find a way to twist it. And, you know, it's I've been in that world and it really is, it's dirty. People play dirty and it's just, so you really, really have to be hyper focused on everything you say, and you can't really make promises to your constituents because, you know, if something happens, then somehow like election cycles come up and, you know, you want to be reelected. And so you have to play this fine game of like, it's like a fine line of like, okay, well, I did promise this and then you broke a promise, or that person's. So it becomes this thing where you really want to be so neutral that you almost don't commit to anything. And I feel like that then becomes toxic in itself, you know, and then that makes people feel like you're telling half truths, where it's just like the difference between the statement mistakes were made or I made a mistake. And, you know, that I think that's kind of the way that you have to, you know, keep the balance in the world of politics. And, you know, so I think that it really comes down to, I've really been personally enjoying being behind the scenes and not being, you know, in any elected office, not running for no office, you know, not really working in these areas directly. And so that way you can do the work, you can do the work and you can get things done and you can collaborate and you don't have to worry about like, oh, well, what are the optics? And oh, and like for a while, I mean, I could just wear my hair natural. I could just do whatever, I could wear whatever I want. I can, you know, kind of, I don't know. I'm always been like this kind of like, yeah, I'm not going to say any old crazy thing. And I want to be very cognizant of like, you know, you're not just, I'm never going to say nothing crazy, but at the same time, it's just like, somebody's going to take that out of context and somebody's going to isolate that sound bite and try to turn it into something that I didn't say or didn't do, or take a picture and then just be like, oh, look at her. She's with so-and-so person. And this means, so
I can never run for office. They would give me real quick. But how do you feel about term limits and just in general, just like take it? Like, I feel like if there was term limits to say, hey, if you run for office, it's like Caesar, you're in there for a term and you're out, that's it. And then the money out of politics.
I don't know. I'm not a huge proponent of term limits per se. For example, I used to work for a state senator, and state senators and state reps are term limited. And that's like a relatively new policy in Michigan. Maybe the last 25 to 30 years that's been new. And I think that sometimes, because the election cycles, people spend so much time like, oh, I got to run for office again in 3 years, or I got to run for office again in 2 years. So let me, you know, I have to do this, I have to do that. And, you know, you spend so much time getting ready to run for office, you know, especially in that first year or run for reelection, that you really want to build something. I think that sometimes it takes a while to get to know, you know, the district, and then districts change because of, you know, redistricting and census information comes out and you have a whole new, either a district or the population is. So you have to get to know.
Yeah.
And I think this question, I would answer it different. Right now, I feel like I'm answering it from the perspective of the Michigan legislature in particular, because I'm not sure if other state senators are term limited the way we are in Michigan, you know. But I do think in Congress, if you've been in office for 25 years, that's, I don't know. I do think that there should be a generation that's encouraged to do something new. But I also think that it takes a while to get acclimated to, you know, the needs of the people you serve, and you need more than just, you know, I think that, you know, 6 years or something, I think that we're confined to in the, you know, House and the Senate, you would need a little bit more than that to really build something.
Yeah. But like, see, I come from it from, you know, just a super outsider who is just like, just sees a mess. Right. And I think the benefits of a term limit would outweigh the negative aspects of it. Like you said, I think the most positive thing from like someone just staying there really long is that you will hope that they can get a lot done. But we have senators that's been there for 6 years and has done nothing but just vote, you know, whatever keeps them in office, you know. But with that term limit, it means it's less likely that you know, a third party or outside money can just like pay you off for the rest of your life and just be like, just vote how we want you to forever. You know, if you're in there for a term or two, then you're there for a purpose, right? You kind of go in to do something, you come out, and then you got fresh people going in, and everyone's always enthusiastic and they're fresh and new.
Yes.
That's not just young people. That's just like, you could have an older person or not, but also the bad side of people being there so long, that you can have somebody who everybody is just used to and they're a Democrat, and then they die.
Have name recognition. And so people just,
but then when they're out, then it's a free for all, you know. There is like, okay, we can finally switch it to the other side. And, you know, be like, someone be like, hey, your whole life you've been under this person, try something different. And it's not, it's less back and forth like the presidency, where, you know, it flips back and forth so often just because, you know, the other side has the actual chance to, like, you know, come in there and switch things up, and people are trying to try something different. So I think the presidency's term limit makes way more sense. And we should kind of just apply that to everything, because it goes back and forth a lot. And I know that's frustrating to a lot of people. You'd rather just have a Democrat in there all the time. But I think it's a net positive, because everybody kind of gets a little bit of what they want. And, you know, they're always kind of like fighting and pushing for a change. And, you know, if a president can do something in like two terms, then why can't a, you know, a senator or a mayor or whatever?
Right. I definitely see your point, but I think at the national level, like for like Congress folks, you know, your federal senators and your, you know, your federal levels, and I think that might be needed. But I do think that, you know, particularly in our case, you know, it puts so many restrictions that I think that some of my political friends have said that the folks who know the most about, you know, how politics work in Michigan are people who are lobbyists, because they have staying power. They stay in these positions and they're the ones who have the information and the knowledge, because you're rotating, you know, so many politicians in and out of these positions because they're term limited, that you don't have someone who actually knows. And so this is why, you know, in politics, when you say politician, it becomes a bad word. It becomes like, oh, a politician, you think somebody's slimy, but it's a craft, it's an art. It's almost like the way that with design, it took you years to get to where, you know, statecraft is a skill. And I think that's something that is a lost art when it comes to winning votes. And, you know, when you have bureaucrats who are appointed, they're appointed and they come with a extensive, impressive resume. They come with years of experience. And that's a leadership skill. And I think that it's needed. You need folks to be able to learn the ins and outs. But I think the problem then comes when there are so many other, you know, when people talk about politics, there are so many, you know, ways that you could define it. You know, politics is also the relationships that are the undercurrent of why certain things, certain legislature didn't pass or did pass. And there's a lot of politicking that happens, you know, so you might say like, oh, okay, you had this congressperson for so long and they didn't do anything, where it's just like, well, who was in power? You know, and if you have, you know, certain people in power who are never going to make this, you know, gun violence legislation, you know, go through, or they're never going to support, you know, programs that educate folks who are living in poverty, or providing, you know, social service programs, or, you know, so it becomes this thing where it's just like certain programs aren't going to get support, you know, so does it really even matter that you're changing people, because you have somebody who had all this experience in statecraft, but the policies are whatever party is in power is going to be the one that makes the rules, that makes the policies. And so I think that bureaucracy is very bloated and is very complicated, and there's so many aspects to at the state, local, and federal level to like making things come together that it can be real convoluted.
I think yeah, I agree with you for the most part. It's just, have you ever seen the movie Head of State, you know, with Chris Rock?
Oh my gosh, why was I watching that recently? Like literally like 2 months ago, it was just on. And I'm like, yeah, this is ridiculous. And it was pre-Obama. So they were like,
yeah, it was pre-Obama,
black president. And this is why there would never be a black. And it's just like, I don't know. And also Chris Rock, I don't know how I feel about him as of late.
Yeah. We skip over Chris
that
Rock.
That Netflix.
It was a lot. Yeah.
No,
I didn't like that either.
I hated it. And I'm just like, what is this? Why is he?
It was venting. That's what that was. But in that movie, at the end of it, it was always like my favorite part. It was like, how are you going to represent the poor if you ain't never been poor? How are you going to like talk about drugs if you ain't never done none? You know, you don't know, like the politicians seem like, you know, they're like, I'm the smartest in the room. I know best, but I've never been through any of these things. You know, I've talked to people who've been through these things, but not me. You know, I think that's why people gravitate to AOC so much, is because, you know, she was a bartender. She
went
is
through
genuine.
all of it.
Yeah, she went through that stuff. And if we had more politicians, it's kind of rotating out that was just regular people first. We could understand their points better rather than saying, you know, I went to Harvard and now I'm a politician. Like, you don't know me. Like, you over here, like, making these decisions. So it's really hard to just kind of be a part of any of this, you know, because I'm like, the people running the stuff, I would never relate to. And they don't know me. They don't know what it's like to, like, go to McDonald's every day for a week because, you know, you're hungry, you know?
Right. You know, and I think this is why we need more of, you know, we need more folks who are a part of the, you know, just public and private sector, you know. So like you have the public sector, you know, folks like me who get elected or, you know, who go, but then you need private sector folks, you know, like startup founders, you know, who can give that unique insight into this is how we run a company. But I don't know, then you get into this nebulous world of like, I'm going to run this like Mitt Romney's campaign, which is like, I'm going to run this country like a company, or Donald Trump, I'm going to run this country.
I really don't like most founders, to be honest with you. Like, a lot of them are in it for the wrong reasons. I was talking, I won't tell you like who it was, but like at the same Black Tech meetup thing, I was talking to this guy who was making like an app that was, you know, supposed to do delivery service stuff. And, you know, he's a really nice guy. But like, he was telling me the whole spiel and, you know, how companies can find it useful and how businesses can find it useful. And I was like, yeah, but what about the Uber drivers, you know? And he was like, what do you mean? And it was like, you're going to have people driving your thing like Uber, and you're saying they're doing like a bunch of pickups instead of like one pickup. They're making less money. He was like, no, I'll pay them more. And I was like, yes, but you're consolidating a bunch of jobs into one job. They would be making less per day and doing more work. And he was like, that's a good point. I was like, he's never had to do that. So he didn't understand.
Right. And it's the bottom line. It's like, that's what folks tend to think about. And it's like, it becomes this thing where it's like the drive for profit and putting profit first becomes this thing that almost takes away your humanness. And it takes away your ability to see a problem that folks would face. And I don't know, I feel like I always know somebody is like out of touch when they come into, and I've had acquaintances who are just like, you know, they'll come into Detroit and see like, oh, well, that house is dilapidated. Why can't they just go fix that? And it's just like, you have never had to exist on a $20,000 a year salary, or not even salary. It's like, you're doing wage work. Yeah. You're doing, you know, just working a job where you can't afford to a $500 like repair is not affordable. And so it becomes this thing where, you know, you can't relate to it. And so I get what you're saying. I completely agree that, you know, if you've got folks who I've always called it like a kleptocracy and like a little bit of a gerontocracy, where you got somebody like Nancy Pelosi, who has been in power and for so long, and I've noticed that there's this animosity towards, you know, the way that she kind of has interacted with AOC. And it's almost like there are factions within the party where they're just like, you know,
and it's age based too.
And that's the thing. And I don't think that somebody who is 80 years old making these decisions, you know, truly understands, one, you have amassed a fortune, and two, it's just the things that you had to go through and your trials and tribulations weren't the same, you know, because these are not even baby boomers at this point. Baby boomers at least had some understanding. It's like,
they ain't got no skin in the game. They're making choices for us, but not for them, you know?
Right. And these are not choices that most folks can relate to. And, you know, that is in itself a problem. But to wrap up, I really do think that there has to be some sort of a hybrid system, because I'm as I'm saying it out loud, and as we kind of get broached into the subject of like, maybe startup founders can contribute to, you know, the discussion on, you know, how to optimize, because if you put it in the hands and I'm like, every time I do, I'm just like, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. That is the wrong way to think.
In the hands of AI. I think that's where AI will work. Like, replace politicians with AI and like,
because they will come up with the rational decision. You put a policy like, oh, gun violence. And it's just like, obviously the answer is get rid of the guns. It keeps happening. But and they wouldn't see the NRA lobby. They wouldn't see the power behind that. They wouldn't see folks' pockets who are lined. They wouldn't see some sort of, conspiracy-based theory on how, the good guy with a gun is going to be,
Yeah, they would just see like the black and white, be like, what's the solution to this problem? AI said to do this.
Right, based
We
on
all agree to just do
probability
what it says, you know?
and facts and numbers and statistical regressions and large data sets, this is what the answer is.
Well,
So,
actually, I'm sorry. Never mind. That's aside. Go ahead.
no, go ahead.
I was gonna say, actually, I don't even think AI even works like that anymore, where it's like doing math. It's just like kind of looking online and seeing like what the common thing people say is. So that probably wouldn't even be the best route to take. You need some like real intelligence, like
Right.
that would stand alone outside of any database, or any collected information from Twitter.
Right. Because I mean, that's where it's getting all of its internet knowledge. I'm sorry, it's getting all of its knowledge from the internet at this point, instead of, data sets that machine learning, when artificial intelligence, kind of came out of all of that, it was different. So, I do want to thank you so much for coming on the show, for, talking about tech and politics and the intersection and just hearing your story. I hope that your story really inspires, the next generation of folks who, were the creatives and kind of found their thing. And, folks love video games. And so, I hope that somebody sees this and they're inspired and they see you as an example. So, thank you so much. Tell everybody out there where to find you, your website, all your handles out there, and where they can read your New York Times article.
No, thank you for having me. This was amazing. I never like hopped on a podcast and started talking about like political stuff and like the state of AI and like our doomed future. I know I really appreciate you. A lot of questions I've never been asked before. Thanks again. People can find me if you're looking for the game. You can just type in Never Yield. It's on all platforms. So Never Yield video game or Aerial Knight. That's how you can find me across anything.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Neil Jones, aka Aerial Knight, for being on the Well, I don't even know the name of my show. Quick to Politic podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. And so the podcast, you can listen to us wherever podcasts are streamed. So that means, we've got Spotify, Apple Music Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and you can also watch our playback on YouTube. So thank you, YouTubers, who are watching this right now. Remember to like, comment, and subscribe. And then that is our show. So, all right, thank you. Bye.
Hi, everybody.